I always feel this pressure of being a strong and independent icon of womanhood and not making look like my whole life is revolving around some guy. But loving someone and being loved means so much to me. I always make fun of it and stuff. But isn't everything we're doing in life a way to be loved a little more?
Hello, and welcome to The Letterboxd Show, a podcast about the movies people love watching from Letterboxd, the social network for people who love watching movies. Each episode, your host Slim, that's me, and Gemma are joined by a Letterboxd friend for a chat about their four favorite films. As you listen along, we'll have links in the episode notes, so there's no excuse not to add these films to your watch lists. We also have a new sister podcast, Weekend Watch List, which comes out weekly on Thursdays featuring me, Mitchell, and Mia, looking at new releases in theaters, on demand, and streaming from the perspective of the Letterboxd community.
But this isn't that. This is the Four Favorites edition of the Letterboxd Show, and it's time to meet this week's guests, plural. They are film lovers. They live in Chicago. Their Letterboxd bios both read half of Letterboxd's Mank couple. Yes, after many dropped hints on Twitter and much lobbying, we finally invited Erica Marquis and Ben Crew to the show live from their home in Chicago where they now cohabit. Hello, Erica, Ben. Welcome to the Letterboxd Show.
What an intro. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, fantastic.
The lobbying worked.
The lobbying worked. The system worked.
It took a while. It's funny how, from the start, people are like, oh, what are you going to be in the podcast? It's like, whenever they reach out, you know? And we were joking about how when we were on Sean Fennessy's podcast, The Big Picture, he was just like, so when are you guys going to move in together? And this was like a month into us dating. I was like, and then here we are a year later, moved in together on your podcast. So it's a very natural progression in my mind.
Take that, Sean Fennessy. Yeah. Take that, pal.
Take that Slate and everybody else, Reddit, every other platform that got the scoop before we did, even though Letterboxd is the reason. Or is in fact Letterboxd the reason, or is Kermit the real matchmaker here?
There are so many aspects that have led to us being together that it's like somebody posted some meme that was like Herman J. Mankiewicz gets in a car accident, you know, and it's like the dominoes falling, and it's like two movie lovers meet up in New Orleans as the final domino. I'll briefly go over the story for people who don't know, which is that Eric and I both have Letterboxd. Obviously. And we both gave the film Mank 5 stars and reviewed it and followed each other because of the reviews. We both liked Mank and followed each other because of that. And there was just a couple months there where we'd be commenting each other's reviews and liking each other's stuff. And we both admit the thinking like, oh man, you know, this is someone I really wish I could talk to, but she lives in Chicago and she's thinking, oh, he lives in Mississippi. It's like, how is this ever going to happen? But like, we were undeniably flirting, and I watched Sicario because it was one of her favorite movies, and I wanted to drop a little
step
hint there.
One.
I watched Chris Rock's movie, I Think I Hate My Wife, and it mentions in the review I was single, and you can explain that. You thought that it was a hint.
You know, it wasn't an app where you're advertising being single, it's just movie reviews, and I had to take what I could get, and I was like, all right. This guy's available.
I love the idea of watching someone's favorites on Letterboxd as like a subtle, like, I'm raising my eyebrow now, like quietly.
Yeah, I was going to say people are always, among their feature requests are like, bring DMs to Letterboxd. And we're like, no, you don't need DMs. You just need to watch the movies the other person likes.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
You just need to write a screenplay about Kermit being the Great Gatsby. And then you just need to make sure that your email is on that screenplay or that you're able to be DM'd somewhere on the internet, right?
Right.
So, Erica, what would be a movie that you both would disagree on or have recently? What's one that where you were too far apart in terms of ratings?
Let me preface it with saying there are a lot of Wong Kar Wai films that I love, but In the Mood for Love is not one of them. It did not do. I think it's beautiful. It didn't grab me compared to a few. Fallen Angels is probably my favorite of his. That really grabs me from start to finish. And In the Mood for Love, while I respect what it's doing, I think by like midway through, I feel like I get it. And you know, it's not top Wong Kar Wai for me personally. But he's a big fan.
Yeah, it's a 5-star for me.
I watched it recently. I gave it 3.5 stars and I was crucified.
This is not a safe space for you, Slim.
It was like a scarlet letter on me for rating that movie 3.5 stars. People were beside themselves.
Okay, well, since I just want to jump in here and move things along. Since we're in the mood for love.
That's really good.
Thank you. I've been working on my segues. The four films you have chosen to talk about are not your Letterboxd four favorites, but four films that you have selected together for a very specific reason, which is romance. In fact, I will say that one of these films is in Erica's four faves. So that is worth noting.
Yes.
And would be in my four faves if I could have 14 four faves. Anyway, so the four films, well, the few chases are Before Sunrise, Moonstruck, WTC Views, and The Apartment.
Let's kick things off with the big one. The first of the four favorites for this episode. This one has been sitting on my watch list for eons. So I finally checked things off. I had not seen Before Sunrise.
Wow.
1995, Richard Linklater. 4.3 average on Letterboxd and 17,000 fans.
Yeah.
This is what one of the movies I would consider a Letterboxd movie. So maybe the listeners kind of understand what that means.
And to explain a bit more about what that means, we've got a few lists that where we've gone through and created some Letterboxd crew lists based on the films that have the most fans. That is, the films that the most Letterboxd members have as one of their four favorites. And
interesting.
It is, as Slim says, a Letterboxd movie.
It's kind of transcendent in that way. There's definitely an X factor to it.
The synopsis: can the greatest romance of your life last only one night? On his way to Vienna, American Jesse meets Selena, a student returning to Paris. After long conversations, they forge a surprising connection between them. Jesse convinces Selena to get off the train with him in Vienna. Since his flight to the U.S. departs the next morning, he has no money for lodging. They wander the city together, taking in the experiences of Vienna and each other. So what was your first experience watching Before Sunrise? Eric, let's start with you.
I also did watch it a little bit later in life. I want to say the first time I saw it was a couple of years ago. And I had heard so many good things when I watched it. I'm going to use the word transcendent again, just because I would say when you read that synopsis, it's not so much about what happens, but how it happens. And I think rewatching it especially solidified this for me. Things that might be taken for granted in other movies, like chemistry and body language and dialogue, it's so well done in Before Sunrise. I mean, the setting is spectacular and it's still got that low budget real feeling to it. So for me, it's a beautiful story. It's also so many great cinematic choices, like executed perfectly. I can't imagine anyone other than Ethan Hawke and Julie Depley in those roles. Richard Linklater's script is phenomenal. So it's a lot of pieces coming together and it makes magic to me.
Yeah.
For me, there is a lot about Linklater's work that I just personally identify with. Like the part whenever Ethan Hawke is on the train, he's talking about, I wish there was like a television station that showed like, you know, someone's life for 24 hours, like every day. I'm just all about that. Like, that's how my brain functions. Like, there's things that he says in that movie where I'm like, that's literally me. And it's funny that like us watching it, we watched it the other day and we can draw parallels to our own lives and, Before Sunrise. And whenever he's just like, hey, I don't have money for a hotel. Like Erica would have been like, bye. You know, like whenever I flew her down to New Orleans for our first, you know, date in person, if I'd been like, listen, we're going to go sleep in the park, she'd be like, I'm flying home. So it was funny, the like way of connecting. This was really interesting. Whenever we first started talking, she said, it's funny, like, if we'd met 20 years ago, we would have had to meet in a Blockbuster. And I was just like, that's such a good idea for a movie. I was like, can you imagine like Before Sunrise set in a Blockbuster? So anyone who's been in love watches that movie and goes, oh, hey, I'm seeing myself. You know, it's impossible not to, you know, feel, you know, your own emotions and connect to your own life.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of Letterboxd lists that Before Sunrise is the root of in terms of, I guess, a particular feel of genre. Like here are some: The Absolute Beauty in Everyday's Mundanity, What a Difference a Day Makes, Two Lost Souls Find Comfort, Films So Lovely They Act as a Blanket on a Cold Winter Night, People Walking Idly Through European Cities in Warm Weather Talking About Philosophical Stuff and Random Shit. So, you know, there's a thing, right? And there are many, many movies that do this. Yeah.
It's so deceptively simple, right? When you list out those tropes, but it really takes a lot to execute it well. So that's what I think is so fascinating about Before Sunrise. And off the top of my head, I can't think of maybe another one that would fall into that. But you're right. Those plot lines and tropes are just everywhere in films now.
Here's a question that might be belying my age, but did anyone else here see Before Sunrise in a theater when it first released?
I mean,
I don't think
well, I would have either been like negative 1 month old or I don't know. I would have either been like a few months old or a negative 1 month old.
That was one of my notes, Gemma, was I wish I had seen this before there were two other movies.
Yes.
Like, I wish I was able to experience this story as its own thing, you know, them just kind of agreeing to see each other in 6 months, not like exchanging information, and that's just how the movie ends. Like, that would have blew my mind at
the
time.
Oh my God, Slim. So that's the reason I asked, is because when you sent through your list of films, Erica and Ben, I thought, am I gonna watch Before Sunrise again for the first time since I saw it in the mid-90s when it came out in cinemas?
Oh, wow.
Or am I going to finally watch Before Midnight, which I haven't seen yet? So instead, I watched Before Midnight, the third film. And here's the thing. It's, you know.
It better not be a spoiler.
No, it's not a spoiler, but you should definitely watch, you know, any film whenever it comes out. And we're going to talk about The Apartment soon, which is like a 1960 movie. And there's something so special about being of the generation to have been able to watch all of the Before movies, to your point, Slim, as they came out. Seeing Before Sunrise in the 90s, before social media, about a year before I got on a flight for the first time and went to Europe and definitely had a Before Sunrise experience. And then 10 years later, getting to see Jesse and Celine again. And then again, like, how beautiful to have been able to live that. So I feel really privileged to be in the generation that I'm in for that experience. But yeah, I was really interested, Slim, in your experience of watching it, knowing that there are more.
Right.
Because in the 90s, we didn't know there would be more. And it's just like it sat there for a decade, just being this kind of like, but did they ever meet each other again?
I mean, watching the theater would be one thing. If I could, I would love to be someone who saw it in the theater, but then found out that they were actually making another one 10 years later. I can't imagine like the euphoria that would come from that news.
And not only that, but the beautiful way that they have really connected as three creators in terms of the following two movies. You know, like they did improvise a lot in the first one, but even more so, they've become deeper and deeper collaborators, and especially Julie as a storyteller.
I actually have not seen any of the others because, like I mentioned, I saw the first one a couple of years ago, and I almost watched the sequel the following night, and I stopped, and I thought, I need to give this time to breathe.
10 years.
It's so cool. Yeah, 10 years.
So much later than the original. So I'm still waiting to see the follow-ups. I don't think I'll wait 10 years per se, but I'm going to give it some breathing room because it left me stunned, and I kind of wanted to live in that space for a while.
It is interesting that people like marathon all three movies and they'll just watch them in a day. And like, I would just like collapse afterwards because you're living a life if you do. They're not long movies, but those are like, you know, three decades, and it's just a full life. So I fully think that's the way you should watch it, is you should definitely have time to breathe. And, you know, even put yourself in the mindset of, oh, does Jesse meet up with her again? or are they meant to be together? Like, it is more beautiful that you're able to build your own movie afterwards, which to me, the best movies don't end when the movie's done. Once the movie's done, you go home and you're thinking about what happens next and you don't know. That's what's beautiful about the best movies.
I lived in Brooklyn. One of my best friends lived in Brooklyn Heights, which meant I had the incredible good fortune every time I rolled on over to his place for a ukulele jam of walking past 16 Cranberry Street. Which brings us to your second choice, the 1987 masterpiece by Norman Jewison, which is Moonstruck. Oh my gosh, 3.8 average, too low. 1.6, 1,600 fans on Letterboxd, too few. I mean, this feels like violence.
Yeah, speaking my language. Yeah.
This is violence against the romantic joy that is Cher and Nicolas Cage.
I love that Cher fought for him and that, like, to be cast in that movie. The studio didn't want him, and she's like, you're going to make this movie with him because he's insane. It's going to be so good. So good in the movie.
So for anyone who doesn't know and hasn't seen Moonstruck, any poor, sad, underprivileged.
First of all.
Yeah, this is a safe space. Remember, we said that earlier, Jim. We can't go back on our word that this is a safe space.
No, this is a safe space. For those who haven't yet seen Moonstruck, I am so excited for you. That's how safe this space is. No sooner does Italian-American widow Loretta, who is played by Cher at the peak of her fame and also her hair. No sooner does she accept a marriage proposal from her doltish boyfriend, Johnny, who is obsessed with his mother and her approval of his life, and he has to go off and see his mother when she falls ill yet again, which she seems to do a lot. While he's away, Loretta finds herself falling for his younger brother, Ronnie, who is a one-handed baker. Having lost his hand in an accident that he blames on his brother, and he has no scruples about aggressively pursuing Loretta while Johnny is out of the country. What will Loretta do? Well, first of all, she's going to get her hair did and go to the opera with Johnny. That's what she's going to do. Oh, my God. All right, Erica, bring it on. Tell us all of the Moonstruck facts and feelings you've got inside.
It's such a film, right? I think what I love the most about Moonstruck, there's a point in it where they're at the Met and he's pointing out the Marc Chagall painting, and Cher says,
kind of gaudy.
He was having some fun.
That's how I feel about Moonstruck. It is a little gaudy. It's very over the top and it's a blast. I think, honestly, I do like opera myself, and for anyone who's been to an opera or is a little familiar, they are larger than life, and this movie really takes after that. It takes those really great tropes. You have the romance, which is wild, and there isn't necessarily a rhyme or a reason for it to be so wild, but it's just all in. And then there are so many wonderful supporting characters. There are so many great storylines, and it's great. I think it's cliche also to say with New York being a character, but the setting is really a character too.
Absolutely.
And the Italian-American side of New York in the 80s that really comes to play. So there's a lot. And I think you don't see Oscar wins like this anymore either. I mean, they're like Cher winning for that, like in retrospect, is amazing and well-deserved. But there were a lot of nominations from that film, and really just from playing these fun parts and getting into it and being great character actors. So it's something that feels sort of like it's from a bygone era in the sense of movies and also in the sense of storytelling. It really does remind me of an opera.
I love what you said about New York as a character. The first time I went to Lincoln Center, I had a Cher moment. I felt like her. Yeah. I felt like there's just something about being around that architecture and having experienced it in a romantically heightened movie like this that just makes you feel romantically heightened yourself. Oh, so good.
It is. It's the romance. It goes beyond the relationship, right? You fall in love with the whole movie.
Ben, what's your history with Moonstruck?
I remember watching it in college and thinking it was just fine. And then I rewatched it with her the other day and I was like, oh, this is fantastic. And it what she said about you don't see Oscar wins like this anymore. Truly, I mean, Cher is just playing a 37-year-old unmarried Italian American, and she's fantastic, and she definitely deserved the Oscar. It's just, it's such a good performance, and like on paper, the movie's pretty simple. But as you said, it's presented as an opera, which is what makes it so beautiful and stunning. And I agree 100% with the New York being a character. To me, Moonstruck and Oliver and Company are like the best New York as a character movies. Oh, man. You just watch those and you want to, you know, and New York doesn't look like a good place in Oliver and Company. It's like scary. And you just like, you feel, you know, the location whenever you're watching a movie like Moonstruck. It truly is larger than life in a cinematic way, while still feeling, you know, you can feel a connection to it. You're not going to feel like, oh, these are just, you know, absurd caricatures of Italian Americans. They're just, they're so funny and they're so relatable. And the film is just so beautiful in retrospect that you're just able to sit there and have every moment is either something visually beautiful. Like whenever Cher's laying in bed afterwards and the moonlight just coming out.
Oh yeah, there's a great shot. Yeah, that was a beautiful shot.
I want to call out a Letterboxd review by Chris Fayle, who writes, "The best romances are about people who are sad and tired. And if they're lucky, by the end, they become a little bit less sad, which helps them be a little bit less tired."
Yeah.
And it's sort of, it's so funny, isn't it? Because the idea, this is such a 1987 idea, that an unmarried 37-year-old woman would be a, you know, a shameful...
Who looks like Cher.
Who looks like Cher would be a shameful thing to fix. But it's so well played in terms of her relationship with her family and the value she feels she doesn't have versus the value that Nick Cage's lust for her infuses her with. It's so exciting.
I don't remember the most amount of Cher movies I've seen. This is the first one I've watched in maybe since Mask, since I was a kid.
And oh my gosh, you're missing out. Yeah.
She's the best.
There. So I'm looking up her filmography. Jimmy, you know what she did right after this? Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special.
Yes, she did. Like, Cher gets it. She does get it.
I'm a wicked girl myself. After Moonstruck, that's another one where it's Cher and Cher's hair. It's just,
Oh, Cher's hair. She's the best. I also want to call out a Letterboxd list that is movies with the best pasta or noodle scenes.
Ooh, wow.
Which the next film, I think one of the other films we're going to talk about also fits into this, but we'll get to that.
I agree.
But I'm like, how many films are on this list? Because I love a good pasta and noodle scene. And there's a lot of movies on this list, but Moonstruck is definitely right up there.
I was going to say there are some great reviews. Italians are POC. Proud of Cher. That comes from Jared on Letterboxd.
I love that so much. But like, let's talk about the food. Let's talk about Rose Castorini. Yeah. I mean, we just need to take a moment for Olympia Dukakis, right? Like, what is that line? And yeah, Slim, you got to drop it in here, aren't you? The one about the old man, if you give those dogs another piece of my food,
I'm going to kick you till you're dead.
People don't talk that way in movies anymore. And I want to hear more like truthful abuse, family abuse.
Little things like that. I mean, it's like, it's almost meditative, right? Like the food, gosh, New York's a character. The food's a character. It's a lot. It's a lot of really, really well done world building.
Our next movie on the faves is a very curious one. I'm anxious to get into it. It's WTC View from 2005. And Jack, who puts our facts together, mentioned in our notes that this doesn't even have an average rating yet because it only has 55 views on Letterboxd.
What? So
this might be the most obscure film that we've covered on this podcast. And the synopsis is a gay man in Soho tries to come to terms with a new reality after 9/11. So, Ben, why this film? Why this film with our romantic picks, in your words?
Well, I know it does seem like an odd thing to throw in there, a film about, you know, a man dealing with 9/11. But I'm very excited to talk about this because it does have just 50 views. It is the most awkward film to throw in there about romance and finding love. But this is about a gay man living in Soho who has just gone through a breakup. And really, his ex is trying to comfort him during the time when everyone is freaking out. And he has a one-night stand with a man who would potentially be a roommate. And that, to me, is the most beautiful scene in the movie, where this guy has just been desperate to have any kind of affection. He's been going through the worst kind of loneliness and, you know, this horrific time. And whenever people come and view the apartments, he's trying to get a new roommates, they're always talking about 9/11 because his window has had a perfect view of the World Trade Center. So they'd go to the window and they're like, oh man, did you see it? And he like, he'd never want to talk about it.
Oh man, every time. So every time that shot happens, it's shot from the perspective of the window and the potential roommate will walk towards the window and be looking out at the view. And then you see the moment they realize and you see Eric, Michael Urie, who's wonderful behind them, realize that they've just realized. And then this sort of his shoulders go down and his hackles go up, right? Because he knows the question's coming.
Could you see them from here?
Oh, yeah. Right at the end of the street, huge.
But you weren't here when they...
Saw the whole thing out the window.
God, that must have been horrific.
You know, yeah.
How far from the...
I don't know, 12 blocks maybe?
Well, was there any,
No. Strangely enough, the wind blew most of that stuff towards Brooklyn.
Oh, Brooklyn.
And then, and pretty much every single one of them is like, did you see it? And then it leads to yet another extraordinary conversation, like so many conversations that happen in that week following that horrendous event. It's, yeah, it's so, so this, Brian Sloan wrote this as a play for the New York Film Fringe Festival 2003. So very soon after the events of 9/11.
It's very, very low budget.
Yeah, very low budget. Then 2005 turned it into this essentially single location. I understand that the play, and I understand this from one Letterboxd review from a reviewer who saw the play and is on Letterboxd and has reviewed the film as well, but that the play was set only in the room that he was letting, whereas in the film we get to see the hallway, the door, the kitchen, his bedroom, you know, so it sort of gets to branch out a little bit, but it's still one of those tiny pre-war kind of painted over multiple times, kind of slightly scungy feeling New York apartments, right?
I do believe you can tell it's based on a play when you watch it, but that's not a detriment to it. Like you said, the shot of everyone at the window and you look out and see where the towers were, you never see anything smoking. And that to me, you know, makes it far more powerful that it's really focused on the raw human emotions and not on showing, you never see like a plane hit one of the buildings. They never use your emotions in that way. And I'm going to say the majority of films about 9/11 are very bad. The reason why I watched this film was because I last year I worked on a documentary film project called America September, where I collected Where Were You on 9/11 stories from every state in America and all over the world. And I did little videos I do on YouTube, like analyzing culture things related to the attacks. So I did one that was like talking about every film about September 11th. And there are so many bad ones. And really, it's just, you know, United 93 is the best one. There's 25th Hour, which is fantastic. And then there's WTCV, which I had never heard of. And I only found it from doing my research or trying to watch every film on 9/11. And then I watched it and I was so blown away. And for me, like the reason why I'm also including it now is because of the scene with the one night stand where he is able to connect with someone and share a loving moment in one of the worst periods of his life. It's so interesting this film was made so soon afterwards because so much of it resonates now and feels like the way people would, like it's, it has anti-Giuliani moments at that time. And it was not, people weren't anti-Giuliani, you know, they thought he was the best guy ever. And it also, there's a wonderful moment at the end when he's moving, himself out of the apartment. And his friend asks, what are you thinking right now? And he's like, oh, I'm nostalgic right now. And she's like, why are you nostalgic? This apartment is terrible. I don't understand. You know, it has no heat in the winter. And she's basically making a commentary on how people like, I wish things were like 9/12 again. And they refuse to acknowledge any bad things that happened. And so it's so interesting that a film made so soon afterwards was kind of making a commentary on what we view now, that people will have this false nostalgia. There's even like, he talks about like wanting revenge and how you need to be a patriot. And there's just so many interesting things that really give you a snapshot of that time period. And like I said, the moment whenever the one night stand, the man he is with was at the World Trade Center that day. And that is what really kind of changes the way he views things and he reacts, because he doesn't want to talk about, you know, the attacks, these people that are looking at the room. And then the guy comes and he doesn't want to talk. And so he's like, oh, well, what happened? And he mentions, like, you know, I was down there. I was stuck in the elevator. I saw bodies hitting the ground. And it's a terror. It's a stunning scene. It is, like, so well acted.
I just hope that Brian Sloan knows that my $3.99 that went to iTunes last night is really for him. You know, like, he should just be checking. He should put that up on Vimeo so he can get all that money himself from all of the views that are about to come from listening to this podcast. Slim, what did you think of the film?
I was trying to think back. So I was in college. I was in my freshman year of college in 2001. And I was trying to think back. Your comment, Ben, reminded me of, like, the, you know, the grace period where media doesn't create things about 9/11. I feel like 2003, even, to have a play feels soon. Like, it's 2 years, but, like, in that time frame, I feel like the movies, the, I mean, when did the Flight 93 come out?
That was 2006, I believe.
2006, okay. So, yeah, still you still have like 5 years of grace period. So I didn't know what to expect going into this. Like you said, it's pretty hard to track down. You can only rent it and that's it. And it very, so my idiot self wrote a note in our doc here, like, oh, this feels like it should have been a play. Dummy, it was a play. Based on a play. but I definitely got the play vibes. I actually would preferred probably to have seen the play.
Yeah,
I feel like it was so play-like in the film that it made me want to see the actual stage show.
I mean, there were a few plays that came out, you know, soon after, but, like, I'm thinking about The Guys, which is the one that Sigourney Weaver and her husband Jim, who's a big theater producer, produced, and then she was in the film version. But that was 2000. When was that? That was 2002.
Yeah. Of kind of 9/11 media. And there's actually a really interesting review when War of the Worlds came out. It's a negative review and it says, like, Spielberg thinks 9/11 is just a blockbuster. And it's like dunking on him and says, you know, like, he's exploiting September 11th imagery. And that's not the way I see the movie at all. I see that as any Spielberg film is, it's therapy. And he's trying to heal the nation through, you know, using similar visuals.
It's funny you said that, because at the time I saw War of the Worlds, I think I might have felt the same, because the son feels so invigorated by the attack from the aliens that he, like, literally leaves, and they were like, he wants to go join up to the war. And at the time I was like, ugh, this is too soon for me. But then later I'm fine with it.
They go to that the house and they're hiding from the aliens, and then somebody says, like, you know, occupations never work. And I'm like, I get what he's saying. You know, it's like, there are a lot of parts in the film where it's just like, you know exactly what he's doing here. And that was really, like, the first film, you know, besides 25th Hour, which was right afterwards, that, you know, tried to help kind of make commentary and almost make it real for movie watchers.
One of the things I was really struck by watching WTC Views was how well Brian Sloan portrays PTSD.
Oh, yes.
And the process of people learning to ask for help or admit they need help. You know, like, you hear multiple characters say to him, what about the 800 number? Have you called the 800 number? Yeah. On a really personal note, my now husband was on the end of that 800 number and, you know, running a team of people at a recovery center for a year. In the aftermath of that, looking after families, especially on Staten Island, where a lot of families, for obvious reasons, lost their only breadwinner and needed help purely buying vegetables before even thinking about their own mental health issues. And, you know, there's just, I think about Ukraine, about Syria, about just the all around global needs in terms of PTSD and secondary PTSD. The secondary PTSD of the people who you know, weren't in the buildings, but maybe lost a partner or a roommate or a. It's just it's really amazing to watch WTC Views in light of what is going on yet again. And thanks for helping us boost it up to 57 views on Letterboxd.
I think one of the reasons why it reflects that time so well is because it's a movie that's really, really rooted in human relations and the human condition. And, like you were saying, how people process trauma. it feels almost cheap to take this shot. However, being in Chicago in a big city when the first lockdown of COVID hit, there were a lot. That was where I saw the most parallels, even though, you know, I was alive during 9/11. But just that aftershock that you even get, like, long after, you know, the initial shock, there are residuals where, like, certain sounds and certain smells will set you off, and things that you took for granted before suddenly just seem so different. So I think the reason that that's able to still resonate is because it's not, like you said, it's not taking shots of the buildings. It's not doing that traditional, like, the stereotypical imagery of 9/11, except for the flag in the window, which is a really nice kind of a call to that. But it's really centered on its characters and what real life people were going through.
From one apartment to another, from one mental health trauma to another. From a Brian to a Billy, I'm just going to take a cheap shot at trying to, you know, create a segue between WTC Views and your final pick for this episode, which is the highest rated. I mean, it's up there with Before Sunrise, but this is an absolute classic. It is Billy Wilder's 1960 comedy romance Christmas New Year season film, The Apartment, which has 3,700 Letterboxd fans. It ranks number 57 for all time in the highest rated films on Letterboxd. It's a neighbor, actually, of Before Sunrise, just two spots ahead. And it is number one for 1960, and it is definitely one of the best picture Academy Award winners of all time.
I was about to say, this comes back to my thought from last week, which is I'd love to see what our highest rated movies are with the lowest amount of fans, because I think, like, Before Sunrise, what did we say, 17,000 fans, but this is literally, like, right next to it and has 3,000 fans. So I'd be fascinated, and Jack, if you're listening, please see what can be mustered up. But this movie, I actually bought this from the Criterion last year without even seeing it. So this is actually the first time I watched it since I bought the Blu-ray last year. This is like, everyone's like, oh, you gotta watch The Apartment. All right, everyone shut up, I'll get the Blu-ray. So this is the first time I've watched it. But for you both, and Erica, what was the experience like for you seeing The Apartment for the first time?
The way I even came across this movie is ridiculous. But I will say Billy Wilder is one of my top directors of all time. I absolutely adore his work. Some Like It Hot is
Icon.
The movie that got me into old Hollywood movies.
It is Some Like It Hot is actually in your four favorites. It is your number one movie, my four favorites.
That was big for, I saw that when I was maybe, I want to say like 10 or 11, like very young. So that was like imprinted on me. And with every Billy Wilder film, it's great because he really has his own style. It's equally optimistic and cynical, and it's just really intriguing. So the way I came across The Apartment after being a Billy fan was as simple as me being a young college grad in the big city thinking, I have an apartment, I'm going to watch The Apartment. And I stumbled upon magic. But it was, it's fantastic. So we've got Jack Lemmon, Shirley MacLaine, and Fred McMurray, who is honestly doing like such a good job at being the smarmiest dude.
I know, he's like, Fred McMurray for me is just, he's a nice guy. This was like watching Tom Hanks play Adolf Hitler or something. It was like,
it's like a 180. I mean, and there's a scene that I love where it's Christmas morning and he's in his house in the suburbs and he has his little robe on. He looks adorable, but he's just an absolute asshole. And you just want to strangle him. So, I mean, I think that magic here is it's a movie about a relationship, and it's a love story. It's also a lot about your own loneliness and finding a way to be a little, like we were saying, a little less lonely towards the end and a little happier at the end. I think that that's what Wilder does really well, is he can like speak to the human condition in a way that's real. It's also really entertaining. I mean, these are some big stars. They were like top of their game when they made this. and everyone's just firing on all cylinders. And at the same time, there are points, I mean, I still tear up when I watch it. I don't think I've ever gotten through this movie without tearing up a little.
It's amazing that the movie ends off with a suicide joke and then you're smiling. Like, it's so insane that Wilder was able to do that and make it work. There's really nobody else like him or nobody since. And
I mean, I've seen Sunset Boulevard, seen Some Like It Hot, seen, you know, Double Indemnity, but The Apartment is an interesting one for me because it's, you know, for as long as I've been working for Letterboxd, this film has been sitting in our highest rated. It comes up every year in the Christmas movies, and every year I go, I need to watch it. And every year I stop myself and go, I know that I need space and time for this film. Wow. And so I've been putting it off and putting it off because it feels like it was going to be a big one, a big watch, a big special moment. And then you two came along. So finally here I am on Friday night, sitting myself down with a cocktail and watching it. And
I do have a question. When you feel like you need space for a movie, because I definitely do that too, but it's usually when the subject matter is very heavy or cerebral. I feel like this is a pretty fun, I mean, even though, like I said, I cry when I watch it, it's pretty fun. So how do you decide what you need space for?
Well, because I also knew that it had, as you said, Ben, content related to suicide and mental health. And I know that a lot of people on Letterboxd do mention that. I mean, you know, the central inciting incident that puts her in his bed is an overdose of sleeping pills.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So and then the scene with the doctor from next door waking her up. Oh my God, slapping her around like that. Yeah, I'm really, really pleased I wasn't double screening or distracted because it needed all of my, like, yes, it's a Billy Wilder comedy, but it's also a Billy Wilder tragedy, you know.
He's cynical and optimistic, which is incredible how he's able to make something that is, it has realism, but it also takes place in movie land, you know. It is in a space in between the screen and yourself. And really no one else understood what it was like to make a movie better than Billy Wilder. The quote I always think about from him was that his hero was Lubitsch, who made Clooney Brown and Shop Around the Corner. And at Lubitsch's funeral, all these directors and Billy were talking and they were like, well, no more Lubitsch. And then Billy said, even worse, no more Lubitsch movies. Like, so for Billy Wilder, movies were life and they were his connection to experiencing and sharing these emotions. And in The Apartment, that's just...
Yeah, you even see that at the beginning of the film. So, you know, for anyone listening who hasn't yet seen it, you know, the general setup is that Bud Baxter, who's played by Jack Lemmon, is a clerk in a huge New York insurance company. And by huge, like, so one of your notes here is, like, do you want to talk about that?
The floor of that building is absolutely stunning. There's, like, the one shot where it shows everyone's desk. I was like, is this CGI? Because this building's amazing.
I want to say that the way they did that was they had adult men working the desks. Then behind the adult men were children. And then behind the children were little cardboard figures. So when you see the film, you think, oh, that office is huge. And it's really just kids.
No, that is some Jon Favreau elf shit right there.
But it really is just, like I said, set in movie land while still having these intense moments.
So he's just a nobody in a suit working on one floor of a giant building where they have to stagger everybody's arrival and knock-off times in order to get everyone up and down the elevators, which is where Shirley MacLaine comes into the picture because she is one of the elevator girls who brings them up and down. And Baxter is kind of the only guy who really feels like he notices her. It turns out that he's not the only guy who notices her. But meanwhile, he's figured out that the only way to try and get ahead is to let four of the executives have the key to his apartment so that they can wine and dine in bed, you know, a bevy of ladies who are not their wives. And they keep promising him some kind of promotion as part of that. And so that's how all this comes together. And it's such an extraordinary depiction, especially in these work from home times of corporations and the corporate ladder. Like, I actually kind of got hives during that Christmas party scene. I was if I never have to go to another office Christmas, the one thing... The one thing coronavirus gave us is never having to go to another drunken office Christmas party where we, you know, wear too much perfume and wrap our ties around our heads. I am not mad about it.
I couldn't believe that this was the storyline of the movie. I'd gone in totally blind. I didn't even like look on the back of the Blu-ray that I bought to even figure out what the storyline of the apartment was. So the fact that he was lending out his apartment to these, like you said, smarmy businessmen, I was like, holy cow, I was not expecting this. And when Shirley MacLaine appeared on screen,
wow,
I was in love. I couldn't believe it was like love at first sight. I couldn't believe it. I loved everything about her. And there is one line in the movie that like stopped me in my tracks about how deep the character writing is, especially for Shirley MacLaine. When he discovers this is not really a spoiler as I explain it. He discovers her mirror is broken and he gives it back to her.
What's the matter?
The mirror, it's broken.
Yes, I know. I like it that way. Makes me look the way I feel.
Yeah.
It's like such a cutting line. 1960, it's like out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And the movie just progresses from that point. But like, it took me like 10 minutes to recover from that line. I was like, that says more about her character in one sentence than most movies can do in 2 hours. Because later, as you move forward, her character continues to make decisions that shows how she feels.
Yeah.
Like, spoiler wise, she goes back.
To right? Fred like, McMurray.
She,
oh my
she
God.
She goes back to him. And I'm like, Shirley.
Yeah.
Come on. I was like, you know, yelling at Shirley McLean's character.
I'm right here.
It's me, Slim, Shirley. But no, like, you know, that just shows the kind of like damage that has been done to her.
Totally. I love the scene where you're hearing a little bit more about her life story. And it sounds really simple on the surface, but how, you know, she went to secretary school and she failed the exam. And there are all these little disappointments that build up to where she really doesn't think much of herself at all. And it's heartbreaking to me because it's very real. You know, I think that's something that anyone who's felt inadequate or felt like they're not doing enough can relate to. And maybe they have made bad decisions because of it. So I love her character in this. And I love Jack Lemmon's character too. I mean, he's
impossible not to like him.
Yeah, I would agree. Mm-hmm. And I think he's really like, we know he's great at physical comedy. He's doing really subtle physical comedy here. Just his facial expressions when he's talking to Shirley MacLaine's character, the way he'll like tip his hat. And I think that that's really delightful. It provides a much needed break from some of the more intense moments. He really knocks it out of the park as well.
I really love when he's telling the story about actually shooting himself in the leg. He just makes like a Jack Lemmon noise in the middle. He's like, you know, and like he continues on with it. It's like his little picks he does that just make him so enduring as a character to watch that really the most important thing for me in any kind of romance film is that the actors have chemistry. I mean, you can have the most wonderful script, and if your actors don't click on screen, it's not going to work. And there's plenty of movies that are just fine, but the actors are so good that that's why we continue to watch them.
You know, when they had chemistry, he's all that.
He's all that wonderful chemistry. Again, exactly the film we were promised.
I was just watching The Apartment and thinking, there needs to be a multiverse in which Shirley MacLaine's character meets up with Dolly Parton, Jane Fonda, and Lily Tomlin. You know, there's...
she could be like the veteran, right? Because she'd have a few years on them, so she could come what's done, or like get her long awaited revenge. Oh, I would watch that in a heartbeat.
Oh, so beautiful.
But this is like just everything. Like, of course, on the top of the script being fantastic, there's just unparalleled chemistry in this movie. And it just is everything, you know, that you've been promised about the ideal, you know, kind of Hollywood film, where the sets are larger than life and, you know, almost feel surreal. And the actors are A-listers at the top of their game who are just unparalleled in the chemistry. And the story is just the thing of beauty.
I just want to go, I don't really care about the Christmas party in the office, but I want to go to that bar, that bar that Fred McMurray takes Shirley MacLaine to. How badly do you want to go to that bar now?
So there was a bar very similar to that in Chicago until recently. It was called Lost Lake. It was a tiki bar. And it was so similar to that bar. And it closed maybe a month ago.
Oh, man.
So upset. Polly McGee, if you're listening, please open Lost Lake back up. It was so vibey. Actually, if you watch, I think it's season two of Easy on Netflix. They also use that as a set because it was shot in Chicago. But they're a good tiki bar. There's really no replicating the vibes of a good tiki bar. Like it is, oof, it's great.
Yeah. K. Austin Collins writes in their review, Buddy Boy needs a union. Yes, Buddy Boy does.
So true.
And on top of like connecting, you know, of people in love connecting with the film, if you've ever had a terrible boss, you're going to be like, this movie's for me. Like, you know, yeah, obviously most of us haven't lent out our apartment to our bosses to conduct affairs, but you're still going to watch the film and be able to be like, okay, I've had a boss who has this attitude before.
I loved how he got promoted to like executive, but he has still like the chintziest office. Like what kind of executive
is he?
He can
use the executive bathroom.
There's like, I love that Wilder films have like cute moments like that, you know? Where there's just, you know, those little small things they'll mention and they're not mentioned again.
Favorite cute moment has to be the tennis racket pasta strainer. Oh,
yeah. That's iconic.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. God,
there's, like, there's your pasta. There's your pasta money shot.
And also, just to jump back to something you said, Ben, about Billy Wilder's love of movies. I think when we first sort of meet Bud Baxter in his apartment where he's heated up his sad, lonely little man meal for one in his tiny, tiny, tiny New York kitchen. And then he sits down, turns on the TV from the electronic remote with the dials that's next to him on his couch. Just genius. And they're just about to show a movie. He's like, great, I'm going to settle in and watch a movie. But first, a word from our sponsor. And he's like, changes the channel, changes it back. Okay, now we're ready for our feature presentation. But wait, another word from another sponsor. And then he's just like, turns the TV off. It's just so funny.
It really is like a subtle nightmare. I mean, like it just showing kind of, you know, whereas Moonstruck shows the beauty of living in a city and like going to the opera and just your beautiful surroundings. The apartment is kind of like, I'm stuck in jail. You know, I don't want to go see the Music Man. I just want to hang out with the pretty elevator lady and she's off with my boss. So it's like, you know, you think like, oh, grandeur, I'm going to go see the Music Man, a big Broadway show. But he's just there like, I don't want to be doing this.
I just want to Netflix and chill in my own apartment without any of my bosses coming back here with their ladies. Yeah.
So it's interesting, like I say too, you know, Before Sunrise and Moonstruck are like, you know, the setting is part of the beauty of it. And then WTC View and the apartment, it's just like, it's focused on, you know, the relationship is in this environment that isn't healthy. You know, it's almost a toxic relationship, almost a toxic environment for a relationship that is trying to be healthy.
Finally checked it off our list, Gemma.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
For the books.
I feel proud. I feel proud.
I'm proud of you, Gemma.
I'm proud of you. You watch it on physical media. You win. You win the points this week. Okay, usually we finish the show by diving into your Letterboxd stats to see a cute little feature that we like to call what you rate higher than other Letterboxd members or lower than other Letterboxd members. But concerningly for you, Erica, you're not even a pro member, so we can't do that. So we're just going to quietly park that and instead allow you to shout out a couple of other films that didn't quite make the cut. And that is the Will Smith 2005 rom-com called Hitch and Gina Prince-Blythewood's fantastic and, you know, definitely rising up the ranks as more and more and more people discover and revisit it, her Love and Basketball from 2000. Why these?
So I'll start with Love and Basketball and Gina Prince-Blythewood. She makes unapologetically romantic movies. You would not categorize them as rom-coms. They're not tragedies either. They have good, they have happy endings. And it's true romance and you are just swept away in it. She has really nuanced characters. And it's something that I personally don't feel like I see enough of. So Love and Basketball, I think is definitely in a class of its own. I love the way that they break it up between the different acts. But I would also give a quick shout out to another film she did, which is Beyond the Lights. I think it was from 2014. And similarly, that one focuses on a singer and a police officer. It's beautiful. Mm. They're beautiful, beautiful love stories. I remember the year that Beyond the Lights came out. My roommates and I watched it, you know, with like some wine, and we were just fully sobbing by the end. Because it was nice. And you just don't always get that anymore. So I really do love this, her unapologetically grand approach to romance films, and love to see more from her. Oh my goodness. Like, please.
When Hitch got called out earlier, I kept thinking about Hancock instead. I was like, why does Ben want to talk about Hancock?
I so clearly remember the trailer for that, and I don't think I've ever seen the film all the way through.
What about Hitch? What's Hitch doing here? Tell us about it.
That's a long time favorite for me. That's a movie I saw in the theater and was just, you know, in love from the get-go, and Ben had never seen it before.
First off, any film that ends with a dance scene is a 5-star for me. Yeah. So whenever they're at the wedding, they also dancing, I was like, oh, hell yeah. It is peak Will. I mean, honestly, like, I turned to her when I was done, I was like, I would have given him an Oscar for that. Like, he's doing his absolute best work there, you know? That is like, it is a peak star power movie.
Yeah, this is basically, it's an adaptation of Emma, right? Slash Cyrano. It's kind of a mashup of...
Yeah, it's a little mashup of all the great love stories, right? I think, like you were saying, that like the star power in that is incredible. And I would say even Amber Valletta's awesome in it. Like, she, I can't picture anyone else doing that in the wrong hands. That would be a very bland part. And you're really rooting for her and Kevin James, who... He's charming. And would I always describe him as charming? Not really. But he convinces you in that.
He's the King of Queens.
Yeah, everyone has fantastic chemistry. And it's also, you can tell, it is an expensive budget. It's an expensive film. Really, really fun to see them, you know, going on their dates. And Eva Mendes just has the cutest fits from the early O's. It's a delight.
She had a run too in that era.
She did.
She
is the best thing in this film. She is amazing. Yeah.
Again, it's a film you can carry over in real life. Like, we were doing a cooking class together, and I was like, I can't wait to get, like, what is it, like, pufferfish poisoning or whatever happens to them. So those are the best films whenever you know, in your real life later, you can mention them. Or, you know, like, if, you know, I'm working with a tennis racket making spaghetti in the kitchen, she'd be like, cute. You know, she wouldn't be like, what are you doing? So movies give us a love language of our own.
Aww.
Is there anything that you, I'm curious, is there any film that you revisited from maybe your younger years that holds up like even better than you remember it? That was Hitch for me when I did the rewatch.
That's a real good question. We were talking about Moonstruck's director, Norman Jewison. I forgot that he had directed The Hurricane. When I grew up, that was like one of my all-time favorite movies.
Wow.
I think that was like one of my introductions to Denzel. And I was like, holy cow.
That's a good intro.
Yeah, seriously.
I don't know. All of my faves just hold up the older I get. I mean, Dirty Dancing, Pretty in Pink, Strictly Ballroom.
When I saw that in your top four, I was like, we're going to get along.
Strictly Ballroom, it just gets better and better and better. But, you know, something like Dirty Dancing, when you see it as quite a baby teenager, that the entire abortion storyline just kind of went over my head. And then you watch it again as a grown up, and it's like, holy, there's some deep stuff buried in this surface sexy film about sexy dancing at a summer, camp. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are the ways in which things hold up much better, I think. Same with Pretty in Pink and the whole concept of being working class and what you feel your value is and how you navigate those class lines in your high school. And and I had no idea who Harry Dean Stanton was in the context of movie world when I first watched Pretty in Pink. And so it's a lot of the, not just the story factors that as you grow, you identify more with different parts of the story, but it's also as I come to understand more and more about the history of movie making and who's involved and how those invisible threads link up, there's just more deeper appreciation that goes on, right?
10 to 20 years from now, someone will answer, he's all that.
I mean, and it'll be me.
Thanks for listening to The Letterboxd Show, and thanks to Erica and Ben for confirming that Letterboxd does not need DMs for film lovers to find real love around here.
You can follow Ben, Erica, myself, Gemma, and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes.
Make sure to listen into our other podcast, Weekend Watchlist. New episodes land on Thursdays with Slim, Mitchell, Mia, and all the latest new films. Thanks to our crew, Monica, for the theme music, Vampiro Stanzo Tech, Jack for the facts, our booker, Linda Moulton, for looking after our guests, and Sophie Shin for the episode transcript, and to you for listening. The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production. Hey, Slim, I think it's time.
Time?
I think you have earned a key to the executive washroom.
The executive letterbox washroom. But the problem is it's in New Zealand, so yeah. It doesn't work out for me.
Sorry about that. At least you've got the key. Just leave it under the mat.
Otherwise, you know what? What good is this stupid life that God gave us? I mean, for what? Are you listening to me?
Yeah. Everything seems like nothing to me now. I guess I don't want you in my bed. I don't care if I burn in hell. I don't care if you burn in hell. The past and the future is a joke to me now. I see that they're nothing. I see they ain't here. The only thing that's here is you.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.